Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young. And get used to hearing that name for the last time, I guess, because like he's going to get married and I think he has to change it or something.
I am. I think we decided we're going to combine them. So we're both going to be Ashley and Justin Paragerbs.
There you go. Wow. Coming up soon. Get married.
Yeah, no, it'll be a week from yesterday. We are under a week.
Less than a week.
Next Saturday. In fact, we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do about the podcast next Sunday. It's a hell of a time. We are in just the maelstrom of wedding prep. We're ending the Contender Kickstarter in a couple hours. There's just plenty of stuff to keep us busy.
Mm-hmm. A lot going on there. You know who else had a lot going on?
Who?
I was going to say ancient peoples, and I realize somebody's missing here, but anyhow, I'll move right along.
Sure. Brian, of course, with us in spirit, as well as over the Pacific Ocean, flying back from, I think, Taipei, as we speak.
Except we don't believe in spirits, so, you know, it's I think it may have been Carthay, actually, he's flying back from. Could be Siam, one of the others, you know, or maybe Skull Island.
Skull Island. He might be coming back to present his greatest treasure ever.
It's like a sick spider monkey. Oh, but they told me, you know, he's a rare breed. He's hairless, Brian, because it fell out.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, anyhow.
That's how we found Ted Johnson.
You know, one of the interesting developments in the development of human history is agriculture.
Yeah.
And the prevailing theory is that we didn't get towns until you had agriculture. You had agriculture and people were stationary. They're in one place. And instead of horticulture, you sort of, you know, gather as can get, you know, with agriculture, you're fixed in one place. You have these farms and maybe you start to build some cities and things to sort of, you know, support yourself. But that's been challenged. There is one of the most interesting discoveries is in Turkey, which is a thing we've talked about before, and I can never kind of pronounce it right, but like Göbekli Tepe or Göbekli Tepe, which is this
sounds legit.
Yeah, it's this Turk. If you type in G O B E K L I space T E P E, you find out about this amazing collection of ruins on a mountain range in the southeastern Anatolia region of Turkey, which we keep pushing back the date and we start to have a better idea when this thing formed and, you know, when it started to come together. And this thing goes back what we would call, you know, the BCE, you know, era, go back 9,000 years, which means these things are like 11,000 years old. And there are parts of it we haven't even explored yet. An 11,000 year old civilization with very complex architecture in the sense that they were moving 20-ton stones. They were building things that were stones may have been 50 tons. We hadn't seen anything like this for another 5,000 or 6,000 years or 7,000 years, okay? So that is an incredible sort of development in the history of human civilization. I've been listening to an audiobook, which maybe I'll talk about at the end, which starts basically with, you know, Babylon and the Egyptians and, you know, the Tigris-Euphrates civilizations and that. This is something that predates those by about 6,000 or 7,000 years, okay? Kind of incredible.
That's insane. And it's something that always consistently fascinates me about history. And you know, just how little we really know.
Mm-hmm.
Like how easy it is for entire civilizations to just kind of get did not make the final cut of what we think to be modern history.
You know, and there are two problems too, is that one is if we unearth parts of Cairo, we're going to find the older cities there and underneath their older cities and stuff that goes back. I mean, there was, we have now, we can look at sort of figure out when that region was habitable and understand, oh, no, it was really too dry or arid then, or it was too marshy or whatever. And that's sort of like, once we reach that point, you know, okay, probably people weren't here then, you know, up to a point. And that's a big part of Middle East and, you know, where you look at like the you know, civilization sort of started is you find there's this dry wasteland that was once above water and had marshes and then et cetera. But either things... buildings, cities get built on top of each other. Are there in places where they're just not practical? You know, they faded away because now they're underwater. That's another big part of it. It's like so much of where people lived ain't there no more. You know, we've talked about Doggerland, this region between the United Kingdom and Europe that's now the sea. You know, after, you know, the Ice Age, you know, after the, well, after we, you know, started to go through the minimum part of the period and we started to have, you know, a lot of melt. Well, here is what I'm getting to is another very interesting development, and that okay. is some scientists, researchers in Israel have been looking around a site near Galilee, which is an area which has been above water, below water, back and forth over thousands of years, and they have found what look like evidence of domesticated kinds of grains that date back to 23,000 years ago. 23,000 years ago, there may have been people in that region cultivating crops.
So how far, where does that put us in relation to biblical times? Because, of course, when you say Galilee, that's the first thing that I think of, is that Galilee is certainly something that is mentioned in the Bible.
So when you, when you're talking biblical times, you're going to talk about it best sort of the... Some of the Semites and ancient Egyptians and some of the regions from which these stories came from are going to go back 3,000 years or so BC, you know, maybe 5,000 years ago, maybe 6,000 years ago.
Yeah.
This is talking about 17,000 years before then. This is when the Earth was still pretty much gripped in an ice age with continents all the way reaching down across Europe, which also meant, though, that the coastal lines were very different. Areas that are presently underwater were not, because a lot of that water was locked up into the ice caps, in the big thick ice caps that just covered North America and Europe, et cetera, which had a very, very different coastline. As we've talked before, Doggerland, which was up to about 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, was a marsh and then dry land between Europe and the UK. Now, you know, it's changed, but 20,000 years ago, very, very different. So they're looking in places that just, you know, wouldn't, you know, would have been way above ground. And now to think that you could have had 23,000 years ago, 23,000 years ago, let's just call it 25, saying they spent some time developing, 25,000 years ago, you could have had farming cities, farming communities. And this isn't some fringy sort of theory now. I mean, this is not, and then I'm going to tell you about the aliens. This is, we're finding grains, we're using, you know, the latest technology we have for trying to understand agriculture, development of you know, human cultivation, et cetera, we're finding evidence in almost 25,000 years ago that people may have been cultivating, which is, you know, like it says, it's, you know, pushes back over 10,000 years. And you so know, this so area was occupied during the last glacial maximum around 18,000 to 21,000 years ago. They found 140 plant species and evidence of food preparation involving the grinding of wheat and barley. They said they found 13 well-known current weeds mixed with numerous seeds of wild emmer, barley, and oat. And so, you know, this is evidence that it was a human disturbed environment that people went through there and they cultivated this and they farmed it. You know, which could be, you know, there's different kinds of farming too. You know, there's, you know, when you start digging, one of the things that made, you know, farming very common, you know, capable in parts of the Middle East was the idea of, oh, let's take this water here and we're going to do irrigation and we're going to move the water from a place it doesn't normally go, which is just a crazy sort of idea, but that made massive farming popular. But anyhow, 23,000 years ago, we kind of imagined people were living in caves, you know, hunting cave bear. There were still mammoths walking across the tundra. There were probably Neanderthals still living in small pockets of places, you know, probably still, I think maybe Gibraltar, maybe around the Arctic Circle, or, you know, where there was still land there. Now we may have had farming communities and people that were building more complex civilizations than we thought.
So let me ask you this, because immediately what I come back to is that, how hard was it to keep the flickering candle of civilization lit if what it seems like we are finding are is evidence that there was what we would say as the building block of modern civilization in farming, and that was completely gone, and we rebuilt on top of it. Like, A, how resilient are humans? And B, like, this was insanely difficult, because if we look at how we believe that we would be wiped out as a civilization now, it takes, you know, tremendous acts of God. You know, it is asteroids. It is all this, you know, kind of stuff that would leave us without any trace of our civilization going forward.
Here's the thing to think about. When you're a farming civilization, there are certain benefits. One is you're not as vulnerable in the short term towards, you know, the animal threats. You know, you kill off all the sort of bear, at that point lion and things like that that lived around you to a degree. You know, you still have to be a little wary of them, but you've sort of mastered part of that land. You have a predictability like I know how many, what I need to do this year to have food at the end of the summer. I can have kind of a stable family size. I know who my neighbors are. There's a lot of advantages. The disadvantages happen, particularly when you talk about a civilization built in a period when you had, you know, during the Ice Age and things start to melt, is that you can get climactic upheavals. You might have 200 or 300 years of just wonderful, wonderful weather, then all of a sudden everything gets worse. If you remember, the Vikings made it all the way to Newfoundland. The Vikings settled Greenland. The Vikings were cultivating. The Vikings were bringing back, you know, logs, materials, things like that. We now have genetic evidence. They're actually bringing back people. There are people who have in Iceland who have genetic ancestry to Native Americans. There was this growing, you know, economy. There was this growing sort of trade back and forth between Europe and America 400, 500 years before Columbus showed up on America. And then the weather got bad. The weather got really cold. It got really, really bad. The Vikings are like, you know what? Not worth it. We're going to go elsewhere. And so they stopped that and they went home. And think about when you're cultivating and you've got a couple hundred years of really good weather, this is great. Then all of a sudden you get a massive drought, you get a flood, or you get one of these other things that wipes away everything. You're not prepared for this. The guys who are maybe herders or just chasing after herds out in the woods or nomadic and keep moving on, they're like, yeah, that sucks. All right, let's go. Totally different. And they're prepared for that, where the people, the farmers weren't.
So let me ask you this. What is the secret sauce that allowed us to kind of shield ourselves from those kinds of civilization extinguishing circumstances? Because even in the darkest timeline of what we imagine to be climate change, like, I think if another ice age happened tomorrow, we believe that we probably could survive better than the previous generations that were effectively, you know, wiped out by it, right? We could live with it. We might suffer losses, but I don't think that it would be popular thought that human civilization as we know it would be forgotten 300 years after it.
Here's the critical factor, and we can look to recent times for this. Let's take two big famines that everybody here is probably familiar with. You have the 80s Ethiopia, went through a tremendous famine. Ethiopia, which at one point was such a fertile place, it actually, during the Roman rule, was the food basket of Roman civilization. You have the Irish potato famine. In the Irish potato famine, you had people who were very, very dependent upon one particular crop, and there was some bureaucratic influence in there and saying, let's specialize on this, blah, blah, blah. When that struck Ireland, many, many Irish people, millions of Irish people, or hundreds of thousands of Irish people, were able to get on boats and leave and come here and go elsewhere. And so Irish civilization was able to continue on, and they still had, being part of a bigger power or being, you know, social, that could trade and could do things to sort of help them to some extent, where had it been a few hundred years more earlier, they would have been more isolated, and that group could have been wiped out, which we've seen other civilizations reach decline. If you look at the population levels of you know, America pre-Columbian, you would see there were sharp declines and drop-offs in civilizations that were just given up entirely. We find them buried in jungles because something collapsed and either they moved on or they had no place else to go and they thinned out. So that's what happened in Ireland. In Ethiopia, you had a massive aid effort on behalf of the West to try to feed these people and help them through this period and reach some sort of, you know, to a point when their, you know, their farming abilities were going to recover to where they were before and they're able to sustain themselves. But that was part of being a bigger community is what helped. Trade, commerce, exchange of ideas, and the ability to, you know, move, displace yourselves was significant.
So has transcontinental affordable travel, you know, affordable on, you know, a scale that it's not something that only the mega rich can do, and the internet, have they done more to safeguard human civilization? Because if we have, you know, I guess it was, you could eliminate a civilization with a regional act of God. Now it would take a global act of God, like the earth coming apart, for all of human civilization to just kind of be forgotten in the ether.
If we were to have like a, you know, an asteroid or a comet strike us that was one of these, cause immediate tremendous climactic disruption, you know, shut down the greenhouse effect and prevent crops from growing. And by the way, like all the major, like, you know, extinctions haven't happened from too much heat. It's been from too little heat, because things didn't have enough sunlight to grow. Just a thing to think about, you know, what's your worst scenario? It's like nothing growing.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly am preparing for things like the internet might be helpful. But, you know, when you want to talk about what are really useful ideas, you know, one is crop rotation. Another is fertilizer, understanding that you can take semi-okay soil, but then we can take nitrogen and we can take the Haber-Bosch process and we can make this thing, these plants grow much faster, much more hardy. And so there's certain agricultural developments. There's certain kinds of grains that we have now been able to engineer and cultivate that are going to help us regain. Concepts like from moving things from one point to another, the cargo container, the thing you see on the back of trucks loaded onto ships, on trains, is a significant idea because it means that I take this thing in one location, I put a bunch of stuff in there, I seal it shut, and then it's probably going to get where it's supposed to go unless it's lost or really evil people break into it. You know, that the amount of stuff that was lost in, you know, through, you know, the stevedores and whatever back in the day, you assumed that whatever you ship, people were going to steal 30% of it or more, you know, and that made it very, very hard and very expensive to try to transport things like food. Food is not a very high yield, you know, when it comes to price, you know, to ship a cargo container of food from one place, part of the planet, to another. If you have so much theft involved and you have to deal with all these other things, it takes forever. It's not effective, and it's not an effective way to feed yourself. It is now.
You know, dude, so stick that up your skirt, Mother Nature. We ain't going nowhere. We figured out we're on to your game.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying the things that are going to be the most important, though, you know, are going to be some of the concepts that we had to learn.
I'm taking big shots at Mother Nature right now. But you want to know what? You can help support my reckless fist waving toward the fabric of nature itself. If you go to patreon.com/weirdthings, we are rocking and rolling with 456 patrons. Thank you guys so, so, so much for supporting the show. If you'd like to do it, head on over there right now, patreon.com/weirdthings.
It means the world to us.
Hell yeah.
And we'll put the link up there so you guys can read about this agriculture development. And it's as you mentioned before, what's lost, we may never know. You know, there are, we look at the early, you know, the evolution of the written language and how that, where that stemmed from. And we know, we have a rough idea of how it began. And we still use letters today, by the way, our alphabet, you know, which was essentially, you know, we took some Phoenician stuff, turned it sideways, whatever. Our alphabet, a lot of the letters are some of the earliest characters, phonetic characters ever invented. They stayed around, you know, and some of the people that use them to say things, we have no idea what they were saying, but those characters have had an enduring, lasting value. That was an incredible piece of technology that, you know, you look at in the last couple thousand years from the Greeks to us, that concept of how to use letters to communicate thoughts and ideas hasn't evolved that much, has not evolved that much at all. You can read Aristotle pretty clearly and understand what was going on in this guy's head, because that once that evolved, you know, that became the format in which we use today. So, but what we don't know is, did somebody 25,000 years ago have a similar thing? Were there people making, you know, their own writing? And what we lost so much of is, there is a period of Egyptian history that we lost out on because the papyrus they wrote on is all gone. It's completely gone. And
so do you think that's you know, part of the ancestral roots of some of these kind of you know, like ancient alien, you know, unknown, you know, force built the pyramids kind of stuff, that is just always going to be rooted in our version of civilization because there were things that came before and maybe at some point we've always known it. We just have no proof of it, and there's no way, you know, except for now as we start to dig up fragments of what used to be.
We have, yeah, I mean, there's in a comment, somebody says, what about the Russian totem that has been dated 11,000 years old and contains an unknown language? And we don't know, if we can't read it, we don't know if it's a language or if it's a simple pictographic representation of what, you know, a census or something. You know, there is a world of difference between, hey, you know what, Justin kind of looks like an owl, so I'm going to give him the owl symbol, you know? Brian, who's not here, his hair is like fire. He'll be fire. So how many people live in your village? Well, let me see. Well, there's owl. There's fire. There's this. And if I put these things in a row, you're like, wow, that's language.
No,
it's just me keeping track of stuff. There's a lot of leaps you have. And the first way that we the way we understand that, like, written language sort of evolved from was, if I wanted to keep track of how many, you know, cattle I had, I'd actually have little clay symbols, little clay cattle made. And so if I had 20 heads of cattle, I have 20 heads of cattle. If I needed to send this or document this, I'd wrap it in a piece of parchment and seal it shut. You know, Andrew has 20 pieces of cattle, which I'm going to sell to Justin or whatever. But to keep you from having to open it or whatever, somebody would say, oh, you know what I can do is I can describe on the surface what one of those tablets looks like. So now we see, oh, 20 cattle written on there. And then somebody said at some point, you know, we could use that, you know, that paraphrase here, but we could use that C for cattle and use that sound to make another word, and then written language evolves. But those things could have happened before, you know, and who knows? But we don't know what we've lost. We could have had an ancient Greek level civilization 20,000 years ago with incredible thoughts and ideas, writing it on some form of media that just didn't last.
That's insane. I mean, and it's just it's one of those elements that always just kind of makes me almost more optimistic and happy about whatever the human race is that we're just like, you know, we are the if at first you don't succeed, try and try again species, you know, on the little planet that could. It makes me so happy.
Absolutely. And that's you start to understand why Elon Musk is so excited about Mars. You know, if we had a sustaining civilization on Mars, you know, it means when you look at the 100,000 year history of our civilization, you know, I have hand axes and stones and behind me that are, you know, one's like 200,000 years old. Yeah, it's Neanderthal. I have another one that's a human one that's like 30 or 40,000 years old. Somebody 30,000 years ago held on to this, and this was the highest point of technology. This was it. And to think for them to conceive that 30,000 years later, I would be holding on to this thing.
Yeah.
You know, and we have to think 30,000 years from now, there will be people, you know, whatever, robots, whatever. And there's this people overly have this, as we talked before, we try to push back the pessimism that people have when things are getting much better. Things are getting much, much better in the last 100 years, whatever. And, you know, it's a hard argument to try to make for people when they don't want to look at the data. They just sort of want to apply their own sort of personal outlook. But there will be people around.
Well, also, it's like, to me, that's the greatest sign that we're doing great, is that we got time to look back on things and feel bad about them. You know,
yep.
like super oppressed. We are just trying to get by and live. Civilizations don't really have time for navel-gazing pessimism. It's generally more survival and focusing on a better day than, you know, a bunch of hand-wringing on whether or not, you know, we're better now than we were 4 years ago.
So we'll shift here. A man in China 3 days ago found a very special surprise in his living room.
China, the Alabama of the world.
Mm-hmm. Care to guess what he found?
Where in China? City China, mainland China?
We'll say it's kind of probably rural China.
Rural China.
And the Shanxi province.
Where did he find it again?
What's that?
Where did he find it again? Or what did he?
It was in his living room.
Finds something in his living room.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, all right. So initially, I guess you would think, of course, It is Weird Things. So the early money's on Snake. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly all the animals are trending high in all the Vegas books. But that really wouldn't be, I mean, Snake bites man is not necessarily, as the old Chinese proverb goes about newsworthiness, it's man bites snake that is more interesting. So I'm going to say maybe. We haven't had one of these stories in a while, but I'm going to say possibly he saw a goblin in his living room.
No.
Okay. Am I warm, cold?
Cold.
All right. Then I will say, okay. Maybe it is just a kind of animal that isn't supposed to be around there. How about an alligator?
Not an animal.
Okay. Let's say he found a 8-bit NES, Nintendo Entertainment System.
Getting warmer.
Really?
So this dude, and they don't give him a name here, he's chilling out, asleep, you know, relaxing, probably dreaming, you know.
Relaxing, shooting some b-ball outside of the school.
No, he's dreaming. It's 4 a.m. in the morning, right? 4 a.m. in the morning, so, you know, fast asleep from, you know, whatever. There's a billion people there. I don't know what all of them do. You know, they've got many, many different kinds of jobs and stuff, right?
Sure, yeah.
He's woken up by a sound of something loud crashing through his house. Goes into his living room, and what does he find there but a rocket engine?
Oh, my good God.
So apparently there was a launch of a Long March 4C rocket. And when that first stage broke up in the upper atmosphere, one of the pieces maybe fell outside of where they thought it would fall. I don't know. I don't really know. Like we one of the reasons we love to launch stuff from Florida from California.
We're just looking at his picture right now. Like he is just like your regular schlub, you know, and all of a sudden his house is just torn asunder. Gigantic cracks in the wall as a legit AF rocket engine came falling through. It looks like just a lovely, you know, ranch style home.
Yeah. He's standing there. Things is just big thing standing right there, you know, and, you know, they told residents don't panic. I mean, yeah, cause what's going to fall is falling. They say it's not unknown for rocket pieces to plunge through villagers' roofs. In 2013, debris from a rocket carrying Chinese first moon rover plummeted Earth more than 1,000 kilometers from launch, like crashing into two homes.
Holy and if you smokes. Look up, all right. So the initial thought is of course, holy poop. That's insane. It would be terrifying if that happened in my house. The second thought I have is, how often does this happen? Subsection, are we better at it than China is? Subsection, as space technology continues to get cheaper, is this a growing menace for every other nation that decides to start putting things into space?
So we certainly have a lot more launch experience than they do. You know, they base their rockets on many of them on the Soyuz, the Russian technology, which is very well proven technology. We have the advantage of we do our launches from, let's say, Florida or California, which means that we can send stuff out over the ocean. So, you know, by the time it reaches orbit, you know, if anything's going to fall down or drop off, it drops off in the sea. Or you take, you know, we can just use the entire, you know, middle part of California, Nevada, you know, as ranges. And remember to think about how much area do you need when you launch a rocket around you? Think about the distance the rocket travels up into the sky. The International Space Station goes up 220 miles. And assuming that something fails to reach orbit, it's going to fall down maybe 220 miles on either side. Okay. That's a way to sort of look at it, is to say that, like, depending on how high it's going to go, if you're just doing a very low altitude launch or something, you know, Once it gets beyond, once it gets outside Earth's orbit, you're fine. And the speed it's going to go is just going to burn itself up when it, you know, gets to that. You know, it's the first stage. You just want to figure out where is that first stage going to crash.
Oh my God!
So yeah, as we see in the chat room, people like it, they launch inland. You know, they're launching the same with Russia. You know, Russia just launches the stuff in the middle of Mother Russia. That's where they land their stuff too. You know, their farmers. You know, their farmers are expecting, you know, Soyuz rockets to launch down, and you know, Russian astronauts are, you know, given knives and instructions on how to fight off wolves.
Like, so I guess there's really no way to predict like where it's going to land, right?
Well, you have, like, understand, like, they can have this sort of area in which they think things may fall, even given, like, if total losing complete control. You know, one of the reasons they blow up rockets when they go off course is because you might have a launch window or an area which you think it can land in. And if you don't want that rocket going, you know, 1,000 miles an hour in the wrong direction, it'll fly outside of there. So you just press a button and blow it up. But you can have an area that you can predict it. But in China, what they kind of say, well, there's only a 2% chance it'll hit a house, and that might be acceptable.
Yeah.
We're using a different math here is what we consider acceptable. You know, they've hit quite a few houses, and we've had, you know, listen, we've had military jets and other stuff slam into houses and the home house developments, whatever. We are not at all free from mishaps at all, you know, but we do approach it slightly different though.
We have seen that there is a difference between American commercial airliner mishaps and certainly fatalities and those that are outside of America, and that America, you know,
let's call it the West. We'll say Western reaction to that.
Western. So, I mean, and America specifically has, you know, knock on wood, a pretty mighty streak going for, you know, just total commercial airline fatalities, right? Like it's been a little bit since a plane has just kind of gone down for
the safety. Oh, yeah. We've commuter stuff, like smaller commuter planes, but as far as the larger, like your 747s and Airbuses and stuff like that, it's so far, you know, we've had a really good period, a really good record of safety.
And that's kind of been past, well, it was like the mid-90s with like the value jet stuff, and then there was the one right after 9/11 that crashed in Long Island or Queens. Yeah. But then past that, we've been pretty good. We have seen a lot of it outside of the West that has gone down. I say all this to bring upon the idea that, let's say, as this rocket revolution continues to happen with SpaceX and a lot of the other really smart companies that are trying to create commercially viable rockets, and that technology, as it does, continues to propagate itself throughout the world. Like, is this just going to be more and more of a thing? Like, will we develop international standards? Is that something that we're going to have to, you know, care about? Is death from above going to be something that is more and more of a reality to people?
You know, it's hard. It's like you look at, you know, our last two manned space programs, you know, the Apollo and the shuttle program have all lost people. You know, they've all lost people, you know, at launch or in reentry, or what have you. You know, and that's kind of a scary, you know, that's the reality of trying to figure these things out. And then, you know, where things fall, there's a reason why, you know, we do our space development in places like Mojave, or, you know, when SpaceX was testing its Grasshopper. You know, they just get a big, big ass plot of land in the middle of nowhere in Texas, you know, with just a bunch of cows watching. And, you know, you try to minimize that as much as you can. But even then, you know, you have a, you know, Virgin Galactic had a fatality with its, you know, Spaceship Two. And as far as, you know, right now we want to try to minimize what happens on the ground. And, you know, I think it's a numbers game. You know, China is a big place, and it's a very densely, even in places that aren't, you know, it's been growing. And so I'm not aware of their, you know, it hit property. I'm not aware of any fatalities yet. So,
man, insane. And I certainly hope that we're not, that we're not in a situation where we are looking at, you know, more of these kind of mishaps that are on a different level because of just the greater technology.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the more things we put up in the sky, you know, the chance that something's gonna, you know, things are gonna fall back down and crash into the earth, you know. So it's a numbers game, you know. It's like more cars on the road.
So apparently, the last major fatality for an American airliner was Colgan Air Flight 3407. 50 fatalities and one on the ground. In a flight from Newark to Buffalo, which, geez, man. You know, that's a real regional puddle jumper, too. I mean, that can't be more than an hour flight. You know, that's a drivable.
Yeah, I was just saying that the ones we've had have been the commuters, you know.
And even that was 2009.
Yeah. And it's just one of the things that's helped tremendously here is that the FAA wisely adopted a thing that you talk about counterintuitive. And I've mentioned this here on this podcast, but I'll say it again. If you're a pilot and you experience some sort of abnormality when you're flying, you know, you're going in for a land and the rudder doesn't respond the way you think it should. You used to be very afraid of reporting that because the airline, I mean, the manufacturer did not want it to be their fault. They wanted to blame the pilot. You know, they wanted to say that was pilot error because if there's some sort of manufacturing defect, that can cost them tens of millions of dollars. And the airline, you know, facing the risk that, well, if it turns out to be nothing, we're shutting ourselves down for a couple of days, and that costs us millions of dollars, right? So there was this fear if you're a pilot because if you reported it and you were wrong, you know, then they would come down on you, and not in direct ways, but you would, you know, it would make your life very difficult. And what this did is it was a discouragement to report problems because, yeah, maybe 9 out of 10 of those things that people respond might be pilot error. They made a mistake when they're trying to land as far as what they thought, you know, the equipment response or taking off. But 1 out of 10 of those might have been a real problem that we never heard about. FAA came up with a program and said, you know what? Let's let pilots anonymously report these things. You know, these people, they're educated, they're trained, we trust them. We don't think they're going to really necessarily abuse the situation that much, you know, and, you know, if you in there, you know, you can think of malicious ways in which, you know, they might want to because they want to shut an airline down for union negotiations or some stupid thing, but it far outweighs, you know, the advantage far outweighs the risk of it being abused. They came up with an anonymous program for pilots to report when they're experiencing things, things that seem like deviations from how it should behave. And that was a big change. The number of people reporting incidents went way up. And now what would happen if you had two different pilots and two different kinds of airlines, but same craft telling you, yeah, this responsive rate in this situation doesn't seem to work. Alarm bells go off. And that has been a big, profound change in the way aviation's, you know, worked in the United States. In other countries, they haven't necessarily enacted this. And part of the problem, too, is some of the pilots, when you look at a lot of the major air disasters where we suspect pilot error, it's not as rigorous as here is how you become a pilot. You know, you can get a lot further and sort of, you know, kind of buy your way into that seat. You still have to go through training, but not all those people who qualify there would qualify in countries with more stringent standards. So you have people flying planes who probably shouldn't be.
And your ground crew,
the people repairing them. There are great people there, but there are also people there that, you know, not as qualified. So the higher standards you hold people to, you know,
Absolutely. Just to put a button on the Colgan crash, the National Transportation and Safety Board did say that this was pilot error. The issues that we've seen time and time again, unfortunately, has taken 50 lives for us to focus on additional attention that these issues have not been addressed. The pilot's complacency and confusion resulted in the catastrophe. Without getting too into the weeds on it, it was an issue that they had a solution for and did not take that solution. But you guys can go ahead and look it up. Pilot error to blame in deadly flight accident last February, a story from February 2nd, 2010.
And you'll hear scary stories about, you know, a pilot with a co-pilot and watching, you know, letting the co-pilot take controls, you know, first and watch them reach for the wrong control, you know, and stopping them. You know, and these things happen. But there is also sometimes a bias, though, towards trying to blame a pilot without an explanation because there are forces at play there. And that's probably one of the things in testing military aircraft is yeah. that these contractors who have billions of dollars on the line do not want to take the blame for something that may be their fault. And we've had problems with one of our latest aircraft systems where it turned out that at certain points the oxygen flow was decreasing to the pilot. And could cause then that would cause pilot error. They blame it on a pilot. Like, well, if they can't breathe and can't think, I think that's a design flaw. Maybe, yeah. just maybe. So, but feedback, information, that's the same thing we talked about. How do you prevent the wiping out of a civilization? Flow of ideas, flow of ideas. Keep these things flowing back and forth. How do you prevent disasters? Information, back and forth, understanding how to figure this stuff out.
Absolutely.
Justin.
Yeah.
I want to send you camping.
Okay.
Do you like to camp?
You know, it's not my favorite thing in the world, but I've certainly had a lot of fun camping.
I'm telling you about a pristine, beautiful, beautiful, lush Yosemite Valley, okay? You've got waterfalls, mountains, greenery. You've got trees. This is just something out of just... You know, one of those tacky paintings people put on their walls with all the lush colors. Right there, beautiful mirror-like lakes.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, no, I'm into it. I mean, this is...
What about for a honeymoon for you and Ashley?
Sure. You want to know what? That sounds great. She's far more into camping than I am, so I think she would very much enjoy it.
So here's what I want you to imagine. You step outside your tent... Mm-hmm. You look at the majesty of nature, these mountains thrust up through the earth like the molars of giants, these trees growing proud and tall, stretching towards the sun. Your neck aches just trying to arch your head back to look up to the top of them. The wind blows down in, cool, cool wind, warm air, breezes drifting across the grasslands, the scent of pine.
Man, maybe you know, Edith Thoreau, this is great.
All in? You all in?
Oh man, you totally flipped me, man. I was all about ordering in restaurants and sitting in my hotel room, seeing if I can dial up the free Wi-Fi and watch Daredevil, and now you are selling me on living the natural life. I'm tired of all these mortal distractions. Let's get back to nature.
So you and Ashley, you cuddle around a fire, you make a campfire, some logs, you're burning the fire, and there it is, it's crackling.
Yeah.
And you know that smell of wood burning? Can you smell that, right?
Oh, maybe it gets in your hair, you wake up, you smell it again. It's the best.
Some s'mores melting over vegan chocolate and graham crackers, you know, this
absolutely.
You can both enjoy them.
I'm almost, yeah, we'll figure it out. We can do it, yeah.
You've got your stick with your wiener roasting, she's got her, you know... Vegan tofu.
Oh, vegan sausage. No, that's a thing. There's plenty right? of it.
Smelling. You smell that? It's nice. It's growing, you know. It's such a serene thing. You're leaning back there in your little lawn chairs. You got your arm around her, and you're looking at the reflection of the sun setting and the moon rising into the lake, and two little squirrels pop up. Little adorable
oh,
guys.
Look at that.
They're like, hey, neighbors. Is this awesome?
Sorry, say that again.
Two little squirrels pop up behind a rock and like, hi, neighbor.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's very odd that the squirrels are talking, but I mean, maybe like, yes.
They're not talking. They're just sort of, you know, just there, you know, and they're like, and they're fuzzy and they're cuddly and they scamper up into your lap because they smell, ooh, that melting marshmallows just dripping down over the edge of the graham cracker.
I mean, now is where I think it might be a little weird. Like, I don't want the wild animal in my lap. But you know, I'll try to shoo it off as gently as I can.
So you gently brush the edge of the squirrel's fur.
Yeah.
And then it bites you.
Oh no! This.
And then
this
one bites Ashley in the face. It's really
not
nice.
Oh, this isn't good either. No, we don't know where these squirrels have been. Oh, God. I mean, like, now we got to go to civilization, right? Because there are definitely some wild-ass squirrels that have bitten us. Like, I don't think that we should leave, probably.
All right. So I'm the nearest country doctor you find.
All right. So I roll, we go, oh, man, Ash, I think I remember we saw an old country doctor just a few miles up the road. Let's put out the fire and roll on up and let's go see the country doctor. So that's what we do. We, you know, poof, poof, get out of the car and we roll up upon your genteel cottage.
Knock, knock.
Doctor, I we have an emergency.
Well, hello. Oh my God. All right.
What's going on, doctor? We got bit by some squirrels.
I can see that. I've got good news for you, though.
Okay.
You were probably worried about rabies, weren't you? Weren't you worried about rabies?
It was a top concern for me. You know, I wanted to make sure that we could get a shot or something immediately.
Oh, when I was a boy, it wasn't a shot. It was a bunch of shots. It was a barrage of needles into your belly over and over and over again, like a little human pincushion. And maybe we got it. Hard to tell.
Okay.
No rabies for you.
Hey, that's great, Ash. I mean, no more of those needles. We don't have to worry about that. So, you know, if it ain't, I mean, but we could probably just get these cuts cleaned out and put some ointment in them and we'll be good to go, right?
Just a second. Now, yeah. You may have heard the stories about a couple years ago. We had the hantavirus, right, out here. Okay.
Sure.
9 people got sick, 3 died. You know, people were actually, were you out sleeping in tents and stuff?
We were actually, yeah, we were out. It was a picturesque, night and the trees were so tall. I had to strain my neck to see the tops of them, warm air, cool breeze. You know, it was really just great.
But you brought your own tent, right?
Yeah, pretty sure.
Okay. You know what? Hantavirus was more from like stationary tent cabins where mouses went and made the little mouse droppings and people breathed it in. And clearly you got bit in the face by squirrels, which makes me think it's not hantavirus. So good news, if you were worried about hantavirus, you don't have it.
Nice. Okay. So cool. So no hantavirus, no rabies. I mean, this seems like an open and shut case, Doc. Why don't you go ahead and ointment me up?
Well, just a moment there. We have had 2 victims, 2 dead squirrels we found, and then a sick young man who have the plague. And we kind of think that's what you have. You have the plague.
Like the plague? Plague?
I mean, it's not a happy plague, you know?
Well, I mean, like the you know, ring around the rosy pocket full of posies plague, like the Black Death plague.
We're
like
in that family, yeah. I mean, if you guys were medieval villagers, you know, you're kind of, you know, you're dead. You know, we're throwing you under the cart and burying you.
Yeah, she got bit right in the face. Is it worse for her because she got plague face?
I mean, it's gonna spread throughout her body, so I don't know how much I would really worry about the fact.
The plague.
You know, the plague has kind of been around and kind of sticks around, and you know, sometimes it gets more violent than ever, and although it's like bacterial. Listen. The good news is that you're tied to history, you know. This outbreak we have here,
that's the good news?
Well, you know, this was tied into what may have been, we think it may have been tied to an outbreak that happened in San Francisco around 1900. So, you know.
Okay. All right. Doctor, I do appreciate your big view historical perspective here, but let's just get down to brass tacks. I've got the plague. My fiance's got plague face. How do we cure ourselves? Is there anything we can do?
Well, the most important thing is protecting everybody else. I mean, you know, we're going to like give you some antibiotics and some fluids and stuff and, you know, however we treat bacterial sort of infections, you know. And if you're healthy, then, you know, it's going to be like a really, 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 really bad flu, a really bad flu that you might survive from.
So there is no way. Like, we are literally just going to try and ride this one out. There's no shots. There's no antibodies. There's no...
No, I mean, there's we're going to give you, like, antibiotics and stuff. Like, it's a bacterial thing, so we're going to try to put that. It just depends on how the ability for it to, you know, kill it off and how strong you are and your own body's immune response to it.
Oh, God. All right. This is the worst. This is the worst. This is why I never go camping. Now we're on our deathbed waiting for old Wikipedia, the country doctor, to tell us about where our place in history is as we slowly waste away.
Which do you want, pneumonic or bubonic? You choose.
Oh, man. Which one's better?
Do you want a bloody cough or painfully swollen lymph nodes?
I mean, probably the bloody cough.
I don't know if you chose wisely there, because you're going to lose a lot of fluids really quick.
And your lungs but like, we got fluids. We got fluids to beat the band. We're a modern civilization.
Yeah,
we
your
got
lungs, we got you may never be the same again. No.
We got IVs.
It's interesting how you went for sort of vanity. You wanted to look good on the outside, yet let your insides fall apart.
There's ways that we have dealt with coughs. I don't know about lymph nodes.
This is why people think that these plagues can sometimes be delivered as the wrath of the gods, you know, punishing us for our, you know, hubris and vanity.
Not helpful, doctor. You are not being helpful. Like, this is the opposite of helpful. Also, why are you offering me, you know, the choice of plagues? Like,
I'm just saying, before the results come back,
Hearthstone.
You know, we're gonna use the secret. You know, what you focus on happens. Now, if we go to the National Park Service, NPS.
Secret.
If we go to the NPS, I read a lot out here. If we go to the NPS.gov, we can find the headline of an article, Plague in Yosemite. Plague is a rare but serious disease that humans can contract from infected rodents or their fleas. Blah, blah, blah. And although plague is a non-native disease, it's widespread in much of California, including the Sierra Nevada mountains and foothills. In a typical year, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report about 5 cases of plague in humans per year. However, during 2015, the CDC has noticed an increase in the number of cases in the western United States. There are 3 main forms of plague: bubonic, septicemic, and pneumonic. Generally, the initial symptoms of plague develop 2 to 6 days after exposure, include nausea, vomiting, fever, chills, muscle aches, headaches, and weakness. And I want you to know, a lot of our listeners right now are experiencing that. Bubonic plague, the most common form, is characterized by swollen and tender lymph nodes, sometimes called bubos, in the groin, neck, or armpit. In septicemic plague bacteria infect the bloodstream, causing high fever, fatigue, weakness, and bleeding disorders. Pneumonic plague is an infection of the lungs that can follow bubonic or septicemic plague or occur directly from inhalation of plague bacteria. Patients with pneumonic plague have difficulty breathing, develop a cough, and may spit up blood-tinged saliva. So there you have it. Don't worry. Public health officials and park staff work together on a regular surveillance program. They don't argue, guys. They don't argue. They're a team. To monitor rodent populations in the park for the presence of plague-carrying fleas. They actually count them one by one and give them a little blood test. They have a little van they pull up, and little stretchers that they put the little rodents on, and then little tiny stretchers for the fleas. The park also has signs posted in campgrounds and comfort stations and bulletin boards to increase awareness of plague. So that's good, guys. We have signs. There are signs there to protect you. Taking simple precautions such as never feeding animals, wearing insect repellent with 30% DEET or DEET, and avoiding pitching a tent or preparing food near rodent burrows can significantly reduce the risk of exposure, which means you have to get them down on your hands and knees to search for said burrows. But don't worry, just a detail.
I'm never going camping.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, there are rodents could live in your house and give you stuff too.
I'm never living. I'm taking a jetpack away from here immediately. I'm going to stay in the air forever.
Well, let me tell you about space plague.
What was that?
No, I don't know. Space plague.
Space? No, no. How about this? How about we just go over our picks for this week?
All right. Do you want to go first? Do you have a pick?
Yes. I think I already did this, but I'm going to do it again because I finished it and I liked it. It is a book called The Bushes. It is about the Bush dynasty, as in George and Jeb. We have one of them running for president. It is a fascinating book. It's a little dated in that it was published while George W. Bush was running for re-election, so it does not have what I think would be a very interesting chapter on on George W. and George H.W. Looking at their legacy toward the second half of his presidency. But it is very interesting if you are to follow the campaign now, specifically with Jeb Bush, and you look at people that are supporting him. The one thing that this book makes very, very clear is they are a political and American dynasty. However, they're not really rich. They are all individually rich. They are not institutionally rich or family rich. They don't really have enough money to kind of live in the way that like the Rockefellers or the Kennedys could live on family money. It's a really interesting and fascinating book. Whether or not you have opinions on the people involved, they are a fascinating family that has been involved in so much of American history, both in terms of industry as well as politics. Just even the career of George H.W. Bush is something that I think is really, really fascinating, especially considering where he is now as just this kind of a political grandfather who likes to celebrate his birthdays by jumping out of planes. Very interesting stuff. Very cool stuff. I would very much recommend checking it out. The Bushes.
So, Justin, I've been listening to a story narrated by one of my favorite audiobook narrators of all time, John Lee.
Oh, yes.
Hey, John Lee has done, I think, a lot of the Peter F. Hamilton books. He's just got this gravitas, this the way that he speaks that's just so authoritative. He's done the Ken Follett books, Fall of Giants, Edge of Eternity. He has done, let me see some else other things he's done, I think, that are familiar with Alistair Reynolds. Sometimes I'll just, if he does, if he near Abyss Beyond the Dream, Abyss Beyond Dreams, Peter F. Hamilton, if he sometimes narrates a book and it's sci-fi or whatever, like Pandora Star, loved the way he did that. I'll just get it to listen to him talk because, he's got a great one. Well, now he's narrating a story. It's really cool. It's about several civilizations and their rise to power and their fall and the different individuals that go back and forth. I mean, the different individuals who, the archetypes you see, the rise of kings, the rise of chieftains, the development of, an incredible, incredible, comprehensive world-building story. And it's extremely detailed because it happens to be the story of how our modern civilization came about, starting with this book, History of the Ancient World, From the Earliest Accounts to the Fall of Rome by Susan Wise Bauer. It's an audio book on Audible. It's 26 hours and 26 minutes. And then she continues on. There's another book that follows, The History of the Medieval World, and then The History of the Renaissance World. I'm really enjoying it so far. It's hard, to do something where you're talking about people we knew very little about, like Gilgamesh, separating him from the fact and fiction. But she's done, I think, a wonderful job of building up this history, starting with, last 6,000 years or so, when we started to get written records and we could start to understand what people said and not just look at fragments we found in the ground to sort of see their artifacts that said something about them. So
that is awesome. And I think that is also a great, I love nonfiction in audiobook, because at times the best nonfiction can be the most impenetrable nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a real talent in general to bring history alive, especially ancient history, when there's not a whole lot of the sexy pulls into our modern civilization for us to really keep us invested. But I had a hard time reading even a lot of the who was the dude who wrote 1776 that's made
David such McCullough.
McCullough. Like even McCullough books, and he does a great job. I found hard to read in print, and I found so much easier to listen to in audiobook. So I highly recommend, especially with someone like John Lee at the helm. That is a dream team, baby.
I went into it because I was listening to I have this fascination with like turn of the century self-help sort of things to look at like what were people focused on in that period. It's it's interesting to read what's the high literature, then what's the literature that everybody was sort of reading. I was listening to Richest Man in Babylon in audiobook form, which is these parables set place in Babylon about building wealth, etc. And I'm getting like, man, like, you know, the description of Babylon's kind of cool. There's a preface to it, and they kind of describe what they knew about Babylon. This book was written in 1926, or the pamphlets were written in the early 1920s. And I'm thinking, heck, you know what? We probably know a little bit more about Babylon now, almost 100 years later. So I started looking for an audiobook, and I found this, and enjoy it, and let me give you the description. This is the first volume in a bold new series that tells the stories of all peoples, connecting historical events from Europe to the Middle East to the far coast of China, while still giving weight to the characteristics of each country. Susan Wise Bauer provides both sweeping scope and vivid attention to the individual lives that give flesh to the abstract assertions about human history. This narrative history employs the methods of history from beneath, literature, epic traditions, private letters, and accounts to connect kings and leaders with the lives of those they ruled. So...
Awesome. And it was just, it was just out in 2013. That's so dope.
Yeah. So if you're feeling a little bit dumb about history and you want a little recap, check it out. And it's amazing because, like, one of the things that you see, a lot's changed since I was in school or even you were in school with what we've discovered about the geological record and understanding, you know, looking what was the environment. You know, we think of things as being very static, but ancient Egypt didn't look like modern Egypt. You know, Ethiopia today did not look like Ethiopia 3,000 years ago. These things have changed considerably, even within the period of time, even hundreds of years, that we're accustomed to people writing about and describing. And so it's helpful. So
awesome. That's a great pick. And of course, all of our picks, we go from us to you. And I'm sure Brian would pick. What's the thing that Brian's picked a million times? Nashcom.
Aurora? He's been on Aurora a lot lately.
Yeah. Kim Stanley Robinson's Aurora is Brian's pick for the third week in a row. Yeah.
It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.